This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. From St. Augustine's Confessions to Angela's Ashes, why are so many memoirs written and why do we read them? I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, the importance of autobiography. Our guest is Jill Kerr Conway. Conway, a former president of Smith College, is the author of two books of autobiography. The first in particular is well-known and well-loved. It's titled The Road from Corain. Carolyn Heilbrun called it one of the few heroic stories of girlhood. The reviewers at Amazon say, quoting here, "Very likely a book you will remember the rest of your life." The word "your" is emphasized in the Amazon synopsis. And that says something, doesn't it, about why we tell stories and why we listen to stories. Jill Kerr Conway's latest book is an investigation of memoir. Its title, When Memory Speaks, Reflections on Autobiography. The publisher, Knopf. Jill Kerr Conway is a visiting scholar and professor in MIT's program in science, technology, and society. Do join the conversation this afternoon. All it takes, a phone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, use the toll-free line 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 1-800-222-WILL. Jill Kerr Conway, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. It's wonderful to be with you.
Oh, well, it's wonderful to talk with you. In your introduction to When Memory Speaks, you ask, why is autobiography the most popular form of fiction for modern readers? Is it, in fact, our most popular literary genre?
It does seem to be, at the moment, not just in the English-speaking world, but in countries like Japan or many of the countries of Western Europe. And I think there are, you know, many reasons that account for its popularity. We have a kind of public culture of confession on talk shows and so on that has prepared a readership in the popular culture for sort of sensational stories. And we also have, I think, a reaction to the postmodern claim that there really is no progress or central point from which one can look at the trajectory of a life. And most of us really want to see the unfolding of a life in a progressive sort of pattern. And so we have a special craving for this kind of narrative today.
Also, something that you talk about in When Memory Speaks is that we are surrounded by information, and information is so very specialized these days, that a memoir gives us something to read, to come to an understanding of our world, of ourselves, of others. And we need not be a specialist to read a memoir.
That's right. I think the language of disciplines like psychology, philosophy, history, literary criticism is very specialized today. And our grandparents and maybe even our parents could read people like William James or some of the great literary theorists of their day, or the fiction of Dickens or Tolstoy, and feel confident they could interpret it because there was no specialized language or discipline that people felt they needed to interpret those narratives.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the language of all those disciplines is highly technical, and for very good reasons. The technical language comes from trying to be ever more precise about very small details. But that does mean that it shuts out the general reader. So if you want to reflect on your life, instead of reading William James or Alfred North Whitehead, who wrote beautiful, clear, expository prose, today you'd probably read a memoir.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think it can offer us a glimpse or a chance of understanding someone very different from ourselves.
That's right, and that's always a great fascination. I think we learn to understand ourselves better in the old way that we were taught in school, to compare and contrast things, and reading a life that contrasts dramatically with our own, or that has some common themes with our own, both stimulate real reflection about where our own lives are going and what path we're following.
Mm-hmm. And also, in a world that seems to be, while all this information is exploding, it seems like the physical space of the world is shrinking. And when we come and rub up against one another, it's really important that we be able to reach out toward others.
I think that's absolutely true. We need to be able to savor the texture and the feel of somebody else's life and not just the surface images of it.
Mm. We have a caller.
Hi, dear. Please don't.
We have a caller already waiting to speak with us this afternoon, our guest, Jill Kerr Conway. Her latest book, When Memory Speaks, Reflections on Autobiography. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our first caller this afternoon is on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. I've really enjoyed the author's books very much. And this is a question I have had for several years now. What is the distinction between autobiography and memoir? And I can't hear the answer on this phone, so I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay. We'll give you a chance then to hang up the phone and get there. Very good. Well, a nice compliment to start off. That's a nice thing to do.
A wonderful one. And let me explain that a memoir is meant to be exactly what it suggests, the way a person remembers their life, and the commitment to the reader is that one will lay out the memories of experience and set them in the context of one's culture, time, and place. An autobiography is meant to be a much more serious effort to check all the details, go through one's papers and letters, work as a historian writing a biography would to reconstruct one's own life. And you're not supposed to leave things out, and you're not supposed just to rely on your memory. You're meant to really have checked all the facts.
Of course, that doesn't always happen, does it?
No, indeed it doesn't. But, you know, in the 19th century, one of the common forms of telling about one's life would be the life and letters of so-and-so, some notable figure. And so the life would be juxtaposed with what the speaker wrote at the time spoken about. So you'd have a way of checking the memory.
Mm.
Whereas we know that we remember very selectively and often change the picture of the past as we go along. So the memoir is what I remember and how it seemed to me, or seems to me now as I write it.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, dig a little deeper in this area of remembering and accuracy. I don't know if you're familiar with the memoir Paula, written by Isabel Allende.
You know, I have read almost everything else Allende has written, but not that one.
Mm. Well, you're in for a treat. If you're interested in it. Paula, Isabel Allende's daughter, is in a coma, and this memoir is written at bedside. And Allende writes, "When you wake up, we will have months, maybe years, to piece together the broken fragments of your past. Better yet, we can invent memories that fit your fantasies."
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, you know, what would be your thoughts on that idea of memory?
Memories that fit your fantasy?
Mm-hmm. And that Allende says, no one can live without memories. And she also writes, and I'm going to quote here another sentence, "What actually happened isn't what matters, only the resulting scars and distinguishing marks."
Yes, well, that's a common way of looking at the past. It's not one that's terribly attractive to me, because I think a good deal of sanity comes out of being quite diligent in finding out what actually happened,
mm-hmm.
not what you thought you saw from your own particular point of view and projections of the moment. So, you know, I understand what matters. For me, that wouldn't be satisfactory. I'd have to try to reconstruct the events and see them from many different points of view as I could, and from that chart my own place in them.
What does the act of writing autobiography offer the person who's doing the writing?
Well, I think Freud was right. You know, we really can remember a great deal if we set about trying to. And so many times we carry the feelings of a particular moment, conflict or disappointment or hurt through our lives without giving it any adult scrutiny. And to sit down as an adult person and relive your childhood and adolescence often is extremely therapeutic, because you suddenly see why things happened the way they did, and they don't seem any longer as gratuitously cruel or hard-hearted or unfeeling as one once thought they were.
Mm. You say in When Memory Speaks that all of us are always, in a sense, writing autobiography, that even if we're not putting it down on paper.
Yes, we're always telling ourselves the story of our lives,
mm-hmm.
and often people go back with recurring passion to events that they felt particularly harmful or shaping in an earlier stage of life. But they never, as I say, sit down as adults and think through what was actually going on there. Why was X behaving the way he was, or Y the way she was? And often if you try to reconstruct it, you suddenly see a reason for what happened, and it's less harmful,
mm-hmm.
less damaging.
Mm-hmm. In your own family, it seems, this is something that I think I might venture to say that you learned. Perhaps your mother wasn't paying attention to her autobiography, and it caused her, to, in a very real sense, fall apart.
I think that's so. I mean, she took the script of the society of her day, which was, that a middle-aged widow was sort of past her prime and should live quietly grieving about the past. And that was the wrong script for her. She was a powerhouse of energy and extremely effective and skillful businesswoman, and somebody who was a super effective volunteer. And if she'd only rewritten the script, her life would have been so different.
Mm.
Now, of course, I've recently been widowed myself, and I now understand her paralysis of grief, although it's not something that I would ever surrender to. But if she'd had a different life story in mind, she'd have got through it, and she didn't, alas.
Mm. It would seem important to pay attention not only to one's own autobiography, one's own memory, and the stories that we are telling about ourselves, but also our parents' autobiographies.
Oh, absolutely, because, you know, so much of our sense of ourselves and our early identity comes from the picture we have of our parents, and it's very valuable in later life to go back and try and imagine what they were like as young people and what their conflicts mm-hmm. and struggles were, and think about them before the stage in life in which you remember them. And paying attention to that story can be productive of enormous insight.
Isn't it interesting that so many contemporary memoirs or so many contemporary autobiographies as well spend so much time mining that kind of, you know, territory, an effort, you know, to recover one's past?
Yes, well, I think it's particularly a problem today for many families because there isn't the sociability and the links between generations that enable one to have many different perspectives on the lives of different people in the family. One's simply left with one's memory of the parent who died. And, you know, there aren't grandparents or uncles and aunts around or other people who can keep up the continuity of the family story. And so somebody who's lost a parent in childhood or adolescence or early adulthood has to go about sort of researching the past, whereas an extended family and in many generations might have provided that story. It's gone.
Yeah. I can't remember the writer's name now, but I will forever remember his talking about, writing about the death of his father and then a short time after his mother and trying to come to some understanding of their lives. And he was left with just these shoeboxes.
Yes.
And he called them the museum of Mom and Dad.
Yes. It's a wonderfully powerful image. And, of course, it's interesting that we can, if we set about it as, you know, determined historical researchers, we can recover a lot about our parents. My brother has just been reconstructing the family history and tracing the generations of my father's and my mother's family, and that's been a fascinating exercise. And has given us many new perspectives on both of them as people, and that, therefore upon our childhood.
And in a very real way, it is rewriting your story now.
Yes, that's right. We, in my family, had this really profound mystery about how it was that my father came to die and what might have been an accidental drowning or what might have been deliberate suicide in a dam on our property. And my brother, in researching his history, finally found his medical records from the 1914-18 war in the records of the Australian Army Medical Service. And they showed us that he had a very severe heart arrhythmia, and that that can often lead to either the arrhythmia turning into chaos and a heart attack, or it can lead to a clot which moves to the brain and causes a stroke. So suddenly the picture of how he came to die has changed quite dramatically, because the odds are quite high that the arrhythmia, which was apparently getting worse, although we as children didn't know about that, had that effect.
That's a powerful piece of information.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
And how wonderful that you can, but, you know, with real diligence, find records that my father was discharged from the Australian Infantry Force of 1914-18, early in 1918, and because he'd been very badly wounded and received a pension, the Army Medical Service kept tabs on his health for the rest of his life. So that those are the records we found. Mm.
We have another caller waiting to talk with us on line 4, a caller in Milford. Good afternoon. Oh, I'm sorry, we don't have a caller waiting for us there. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Jill Kerr Conway is our guest. We're talking with her about her latest book, When Memory Speaks, Reflections on Autobiography. My name is Celeste Quinn. Your questions and comments are welcome this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If you're outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. In your book, When Memory Speaks, you write about the differences between men and women as they report on their lives. I think we should talk about this a bit here, spend some time investigating these patterns of reportage. You want to talk with us about the male pattern and the female pattern?
Yes, the male pattern in Western culture, because for Asian culture is totally different. The male pattern in the West is derived from classical Greek culture and the ideal of the Greek hero and the archetypal heroic figure is Odysseus, who is obliged to endure many trials and tribulations going on his epic journey, the Odyssey, before he can establish his rightful place in society as the rightful king of his state. And in that narrative, the hero, while tried and tested by the fates and by many different temptations and monsters and so forth, eventually triumphs through his own courage, determination, sometimes cunning, and intelligence, all things greatly admired in Greek culture. And so, in a way, we can see the hero as the agent of what happens to him. It's his action that shapes the narrative, the unfolding of the story. And by contrast, the earliest accounts of women's lives in Western culture come from religious women, nuns, who were living in enclosed religious communities and living a life of prayer and contemplation. And their object of their contemplation and their life of prayer was the relationship with God. And if you're relating to the first cause in the universe, you're not in charge. So the narrative becomes a story of a relationship in which one is a passive participant. And that pattern gets secularized in Western European culture, finally, to take the form of the romance, where the heroine's life is shaped by her quest for the romantic partner, the ideal hero. And she's not in charge of that. She has to be available, beautiful, wonderfully, finely tuned emotionally, but the hero has to find her. And so it's a very different kind of story in which the woman is not the agent of her fate. It happens to her. And that's striking when one looks at the narratives of the lives of some of America's greatest 19th century reformers and activists, because to a woman, they always present the causes that they took up as having happened to them. Although, as a historian researching what they did, it's very clear to me that they created the causes and made them happen, but they never represented themselves that way. And, of course, that's had an unfortunate effect in our culture, because, of course, it means that it's not thought proper or attractive for women to avow ambition or talk about the determined way in which they've shaped events. Mm. And that gets in the way of even people claiming their victories at the office and getting recognition for what they do. Mm.
The male pattern of telling a life story, while it while it offers one control, and you are one is an agent acting, one is, you know, not being acted upon. Are there, though, isn't that also, though, somewhat restrictive? I mean, both of these forms are restrictive.
Oh, yes.
One more than so than the other.
Well, I mean, the classical hero theme requires people to inflate the degree to which they are in charge of their lives, and that's a major constraint. Doesn't allow for stopping and admitting fear or describing indecision or whatever. And you know, the female pattern requires concealment in the opposite direction. But in When Memory Speaks, I make quite clear that I think the experience of modern warfare, in which men and women literally are numbers in a massive bureaucratic war machine, has really tended to eradicate those differences. It's very hard to play the classical Greek hero if one's a member of a military organization in modern mass warfare. You don't control anything. Things happen.
And women.
So in When Memory Speaks, in the chapter on imperial stories, which are stories of military conquest or cultural conquest, it's quite clear that by the end of the Vietnam War, for instance, men and women talked about themselves in it in almost identical ways.
Women are no longer that damsel in distress locked in the tower.
No, but neither are the men in charge.
Right.
They are people to whom things happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I don't want to intrude on this very interesting discussion, so please pick it up after my call. I just wanted to say how much I enjoy all of your books, and really encourage people to read your second part of your autobiography, North Star, which I think is fascinating reading for any woman working in an organization or any people connected with universities, or it's just enthralling.
Well, thank you. You know, it's called True North because I wanted to...
Oh, True North, right, yeah.
I wanted to put together the image of finding a direction in life and having a kind of compass point. And so the image for me is both
finding one's way
in a career and also coming into a relationship with a man who I thought I was a kind of moral compass. So... The image is also important because it's ambiguous, you know, because magnetic north moves around a great deal in terms of the Earth's rotation, and so finding true north is quite a task sometimes. So, but I did mean that memoir to be a kind of not how to do it, but a sort of map that people could follow as they worked on their own careers as adult women. Because, of course, the romantic life story doesn't allow for a woman to have any meaning to her life except the romance.
Yes.
And it means that we don't have many accounts of how women get ahead in the world or fight their way through their profession.
And your insights into people taking advantage of your negotiating skills and this sort of thing, all of that was very... very interesting.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And
I recommend it to people, and I got the library to get a copy in large print for a lot of people who need that. So,
well, that's wonderful to hear, and thank you for the plug. I need you on my Salesforce all the time.
Thank you for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. When Memory Speaks, in the book you write, every autobiographer wants to persuade others to learn from his or her life. To achieve this, they cannot depart too dramatically from popularly accepted stereotypes which affirm the man of action and the suffering or redemptive female. Is there still a lot of censorship going on, self-censorship in autobiography?
Yes, I think the interesting question is whether people literally censor the story in order to make it acceptable, or whether they are so much a captive of, you know, the popular myth, the life plot that comes to us through, you know, true romances or Hollywood movies or whatever, mm-hmm. that they're not conscious of what they're really doing. And, of course, much psychotherapy is directed toward getting people to see the meaning of what they're really doing as opposed to how they're interpreting it. I think it's fascinating because I worked as a graduate student, on a dissertation based on the lives of the first generation of American women who had access to graduate education, and of course they all became great reformers of one kind or another in the progressive era and founders of the professions for women. And it's very interesting that you can go through their letters and diaries and see quite flat, direct comments about their ambitions, what they hope to do. And then when they come to write their life story, those are never acknowledged, and it's always a story in which fate or destiny or some external force has brought them in touch with the cause they're serving. So I think, you know, it's very good for all of us to sit down and say, well, now, am I really living my life in accordance with this internalized story that I have of it, or am I really doing something quite different? Or, alternatively, as happened in my own life, do I like the story that's been assigned to me, or am I determined to change it? And I think that's those are very worthwhile questions for people to ask.
Yeah. It seems you are very aware of your life story at a very young age. You write, at 7, I was already at work on planning a life story different from the one that went with rural Australia.
Yes, well, I think that was partly my parents, who had great ambition for their children. It was partly being a child growing up during the Second World War, and every day one turned on the radio and heard these stories of epic battles and heroic civilian resistance and people surviving the bombing of the great cities of Europe and so forth. There I was living in the outback of Australia where not much seemed to happen. And I, you know, had a picture of London and Westminster from the radio and from the newspapers. And in my British world, London was, you know, the great metropolitan city of the world. And so my first thought was to get there. By the time I'd grown a little older and seen the American armed forces rescue Australia from invasion by Japan, I suddenly became conscious of another society entirely that I wanted to know about. But I think that's one of the influences of radio. Perhaps had I been born before the radio age, I wouldn't have received any of those messages.
When you were young and learning about the world from the radio and thinking about how you would like to live your life and where you'd like to go, that was a goal or an objective. And then yet when you left Australia, you write of it as a defeat.
Yes. We all set ourselves a series of objectives in life, and in my adolescence and early adulthood, the central themes had been that I wanted to excel academically and take up a prestigious profession, and I also wanted to rescue the family from some of the consequences of earlier tragedies that had affected my mother and so forth. And by the time I left, I'd failed at all of those things. I hadn't been able to rescue my neurotic mother, and hadn't been able to break down the bias against employing women in Australia to find the kind of occupation I wanted. So in those senses, I really was defeated.
Hmm. I mentioned in the introduction Carolyn Heilbrun, her describing your book, The Road from Corain, as one of the few heroic stories of girlhood. And I'm wondering what you think of that description.
Well, what I was trying to convey myself in writing that book was the story of what a training in stoicism does to a child or a young person. It's not bad, I guess, to be taught just to endure, but often that can mean that you endure for too long and don't try to correct things that are wrong with your life quickly enough. But Carolyn, I think, thought of that stoic endurance as heroic. Don't quite see it that way myself,
mm.
but
mm-hmm.
I was very touched by the way she described it. I'd never thought of it that way.
Mm. It's interesting how a writer can have an idea and write a book, and the things that we as readers will take away can be so not wrong, but just different.
Just different. Well, that's the wonderful thing. I mean, once you've written it and it's being printed and published, it's not yours any longer. It's however anybody wants to interpret and read it, which is endlessly fascinating. I must say the questions that people ask me about those two volumes of autobiography are enormously illuminating. It made me think a lot.
Are there national differences in an autobiography? You mentioned earlier a different pattern in Asia.
Well, the different pattern for most Asian cultures would be not the notion of a journey in time which leads up to a high point of progress, but the pattern is much more that of perpetual repetition of archetypal patterns and of an eternal cycle of growth and decay and reversal, so that really it wouldn't occur to an Asian writer, unless westernized, to tell a story in terms of progress towards a certain point in life. It would be more about the cycles of repetition.
Hmm. What makes an autobiography worth remembering? When you read autobiography, what makes one particular autobiography succeed?
Well, for me, it is if the person has really managed to make me, the reader, feel intensely what it must have been like to be that person in that situation. And then, of course, there are all the skills of a novelist have to be employed, creation of character, conveying emotion, which is really a poetic skill, building up tension and resolving it, springing a few surprises on the reader to heighten the impact of events and so on. Those are all talents of the novelist,
mm.
and a successful autobiography has to employ them all.
A favorite of yours appears to be The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Yes, indeed.
Would you tell us about that book and why it's important to you?
Yes. This is a memoir written, we are told, by a Frenchman who was an editor of one of the great French fashion magazines, Elle. And he was stricken by a kind of stroke in the brainstem, as I understand it, which leaves all the intellectual capacities pretty much intact, but takes away all motor capacity, so that the person is literally a mind and a consciousness trapped in a body that is totally beyond the person's control. And that's described medically, I gather, as shut-in syndrome, because the mind is there, but not speech, not any capacity to move. And Bobby had one capacity only. He could blink one eyelid. And the memoir represents him as dictating that book to a very loyal and devoted woman scribe who sat beside his bed and counted the number of blinks so that it would represent a letter of the alphabet. And the book is short, naturally, but it talks about what it's like to be conscious in this shut-in state and what he thinks about. And I should say for listeners that there have been many efforts to disprove this method of writing the book. And many critics have said this just isn't possible. But to date, I've not found anyone who's been able to establish that it was not written the way it purports to be. But what's it really impressive about the book is that although paralyzed and not able to move, this man's mind is so active, and he is continually undertaking exercises that will give him at least the illusion that he has some control over his life. And when people come and tell him that they've made sacrifices in temples in his honor, or they've set up a program of prayer somewhere in some church or religious center in the world, he immediately appropriates that energy and decides to use it for his own healing. And so what was impressive to me about the book was the extent to which, even when totally paralyzed, this man felt in control of his life, or in control of what he could, control which were his thoughts. And that's a very extreme form of agency, and I hope never to be tested to exercise it, but it does show you how strong that training can be.
If you learned later today that this was not written by a man who had suffered a stroke and who wrote this book in the method that we've been told, would it make a difference to you?
If it were not literally the record of the consciousness,
right,
that in that situation, yes, it would make a difference.
Yeah.
But although people have said it has surely could not have been written that way, I don't think anyone's established any other method of writing.
Yeah. We're here where we have to wrap things up. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Is there anything else that you would recommend that we read? That you do you have a short list of?
Yes, I have one of my favorite collections of autobiographies that will be published shortly by Vintage Books, and it's called In Her Own Words, and it is excerpts from the autobiographies of 20th century Australian, New Zealand, and Canadian women, juxtaposed with American women of the same generation. and perhaps because I come from that British colonial world, I'm fascinated by the way women who have sort of two strikes against them, a double bind in being subordinates in a subordinate world, which is colonial in the extreme, how they fight their way out of that and become people demonstrably in charge of their lives. And some of the very greatest memoirs of today are written by particularly New Zealand and Canadian women. I shouldn't. I'm very impressed also by the Australians, but the New Zealand novelist Janet Frame has written a 3-volume memoir, which is absolutely dazzling, and called just an autobiography. And I also admire tremendously the French-Canadian novelist Gabrielle Roy, whose memoir has been translated into English under the title Enchantment and Sorrow. Mm. And both of these are stories of how women of extraordinary talent get from very, very remote parts of the world to a life of authentic creativity and world acclaim. Mm.
Thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure.
Take care.
I enjoyed talking with the listeners very much indeed, and with you.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Jill Kerr-Conway has been our guest. Look for her latest book, When Memory Speaks, Reflections on Autobiography. It's published by Knauf.